This is Love Your Work. On this show, we help you make it as a creative. Find your unique voice, find the right mindset to succeed, and be the first to capitalize on new opportunities to make a living making your art. I'm David Cataby. If you want to join us here on Love Your Work every Thursday, please hit subscribe on your podcast app. And if you want the very best of Love Your Work and the gems I've discovered in my thousands of hours of research into history's greatest creators, all in a short weekly email, sign up for my Love Mondays newsletter at cataby.net/Mondays. Dr. Robert Maurer is author of One Small Step Can Change Your Life, The Kaizen Way. He's also director of behavioral sciences for the Family Practice Residency Program at Santa Monica UCLA Medical Center and a faculty member with the UCLA School of Medicine. In One Small Step, Dr. Maurer shows you how to make really big changes with ridiculously small steps. I first discovered One Small Step on the Amazon page for my own book, The Heart to Start. Amazon kept showing me that people who bought my book were also buying Robert's book. And so after it had been sitting there for week after week, I began to think to myself, what is going on here? I've got to see what this is about. You heard me talk about taking small steps on this podcast before, including my episode on how to build good habits with BJ Fogg. It turns out there is a name for this practice. The Japanese call it Kaizen. And in this conversation, you're going to learn about how do large goals put us into fear mode, learn about the neuroscience of why we don't take action when we have too big of a goal. And how can you start doing anything with small steps? You can start an exercise habit simply by standing on a treadmill, or a flossing habit while flossing only one tooth. And how did Dr. Maurer himself write his book by committing to only 90 seconds per day of writing? That's not a typo, 90 seconds per day of writing. It's time for the Love Your Work Listener Showcase. Vitas Pinkovicius is not only one of our top contributing Patreon backers, he's also an organist who draws. In fact, in a recent Office Hours, which is available to Patreon backers at certain levels, I got to chat with Vitas about his amazing story of making a living online teaching people to play the organ. This is his full-time job. It's amazing. And in addition to teaching the organ, Vitas is author of Pinky and Spiky Comics. You can check out his work on Steemit. He's at steemit.com/@organduo. At Organ Duo. If you would like your work to be featured on Love Your Work, apply to be featured in the Love Your Work Listener Showcase. Go to cataby.net/showcase. There's a really short application there. That's cataby.net/showcase. Here's Dr. Robert Maurer. I'm here with Dr. Robert Maurer, and Robert is the author of One Small Step Can Change Your Life, The Kaizen Way. And I had heard of Kaizen before I read this book, but I always thought of it as a Japanese concept. And I guess it is a Japanese concept, but its origins aren't necessarily purely Japanese. Is that about right?
That's absolutely correct. It's we've tried to trace the history of it. As you know, the idea of once a journey of 1,000 miles begins with a single step is an ancient philosophy. We've not been able to find any systematic way it was used in any Asian culture, but it was adopted by a group of Americans at the beginning of World War II to increase the quality of military equipment, encouraging people on assembly lines when they were building tanks or airplanes to look for very, very, very small, inexpensive ways to improve the product. And they found these small steps were leading to big results.
And so they were doing that in American manufacturing.
Yes.
Yeah. So how did that end up in becoming a Japanese concept?
Good question. After World War II, we were the only industrial giant standing. People were buying our cars and refrigerators no matter how we built them. But the Japanese had been very impressed with our equipment. And the team led by a man named Edward Deming was invited over to Japan. And the Air Force was hiring civilian employees in Japan. And through those two vehicles, small struggling firms rebuilding out of rubble like Toyota, Honda, Fuji used these funny ideas to build some of the highest quality products in the world. So what happened was Toyota gave it a new name of Kaizen, and they called it their soul. It became the centerpiece of their whole manufacturing process.
So it was
Toyota is just one company that really espoused the Kaizen way.
Yes.
And really grew a lot. And so how would you describe the Kaizen way?
Well, there's actually two pieces to it. And Dr. Deming and the people that trained the Japanese insisted that it was more of a way of life and a way of a culture than it was a technique. And because they were afraid that once Americans got their hands on it, if it didn't work instantly, they would go on to the next fad. Mm. But it has two definitions. One is making extremely small steps to accomplish large goals. And the other is looking at very small moments to learn large lessons. When you look at like breakthroughs in business and science and art, so frequently it was some incredibly small moment most people wouldn't pay any attention to. This particular person decided to take a look at, and next thing you know, we had a new product or invention or artistic form.
So I think one of the really interesting examples of using like a really small step to get a large result from the book was you were speaking about, I don't know if it was a patient of yours or not, but she had a treadmill. And can you finish that story?
Sure, because when you look at the American Heart Association recommendations and the ones from the government, it says to exercise 30 minutes a day, 5 days or more during the week. And a lot of those people that made those recommendations now are feeling kind of embarrassed because they feel like they've done more harm than good. Because the body registers every minute of exercise. So this particular patient was overwhelmed with what life's responsibilities and duties and other tasks. And the idea of exercising 30 minutes, she couldn't do. But so we started as small as we possibly could, because the way you know you have a good Kaizen step, David, is people laugh in your face. Uh-huh. So she agreed that she'd get on the treadmill in the morning with a cup of coffee and her Wall Street Journal and simply read the paper on the treadmill. She didn't have to move. And of course, the step was so small that it was easy for her to do, which is the key part of Kaizen. It has to require no willpower, self-control, discipline, because the steps are so small. And of course, eventually what happens with these small steps is you start to build a habit. So for the first 3 or 4 days, she just stood on it. And then she decided, all right, I'm going to exercise for 1 minute before I get off the treadmill and take my shower. And of course, 1 minute led to two and two to three, et cetera.
Right. And what was the significance of the coffee and the Wall Street Journal? I had forgotten about that part.
Sure. Well, when she got up in the morning, what she loved to do was to have her coffee and read the Wall Street Journal, but she knew she needed to exercise. So what we did was just take something she was doing for pleasure and moved it to the treadmill. So at least she was on the treadmill. That's how small the steps can sometimes be. So she got to enjoy her coffee, enjoy the standing on the treadmill, and didn't have to move it.
Right. So you can always take something that you already... So there's a behavior that you want to have happen, and there's maybe some place that you want to work that behavior into your daily routine. So the way that you do that then is to take something that's already in your daily routine that you enjoy that happens during that time, and then you add on this tiny, insignificant, laughably simple thing onto it. And then over time, that creates some progress. Is that how that works?
That's one of the mechanisms. Absolutely. Like, for example, one of the ways I started flossing was I put the container of floss right on the remote control. So when I sat down to watch TV at night, I could certainly floss while I was watching Game of Thrones. But that's one strategy. The other is if something you really don't want to do, you can do it in such a small increment that, again, it takes no time or effort. I'll give you an example. And again, as you say, these are laughingly simple. I love that phrase. Well done. Mm-hmm. Is you could decide you're going to floss one tooth a night, same tooth. Now, when I say that to an audience, people break out laughing. It's absurd. But assuming it's so small, you're sure you can do it. What do you have a month from now besides one clean tooth? You've got a habit of picking up the silly string.
Mm-hmm.
So the bad news is the brain's a creature of habit. The good news is the brain's a creature of habit. So if you're doing something one or two times a day for even 15, 20 seconds, but doing it every day, eventually the brain creates a habit. You know, the example I love using with audiences is if I draw two golden arches, what do you think about? And everybody says McDonald's. Even if you've never set foot in one of their restaurants, you can tell me three or four of their products because they've shown you 15-second commercials over and over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
Watch an hour of Law & Order, they show you the same green lizard again and again and again, and everybody knows that lizard is Geico Insurance. So if you do something regularly, the brain creates a habit. Doing it once a week, the brain doesn't commit cells.
Right. Well, there was something interesting about this flossing example that you had there, because by putting it on the television remote, you've also created like a trigger.
Yes.
Right?
Exactly. Yes.
Okay. So you're putting it like in the path of something that's already happening. And then you have this laughably simple goal. And then, I mean, do you end up flossing just one tooth all the time? Or how does that usually play out and why?
That's a great question. A lot of it you negotiate with the person, because the criteria is it something that's so effortless, I'm 100% sure I can do it. So if flossing, if we're going to stay with flossing for an example, you can have the person just floss one tooth a night. Now, if they're watching an hour of TV, they may decide they want to do more than that. But you can have them do one tooth and then a week later, two teeth, and build up each week. That tends not to be necessary with flossing, but something like exercise, if people aren't exercising at all, getting them to move in place just so they get their heart rate up during one commercial for a minute is often very useful. So getting people to exercise for 1 minute a day for the first week, and then 2 minutes. And what happens with Kaizen sometimes is people forget to stop. The real trick of Kaizen is you're getting people past their resistance to doing something because they think they need to do it for 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Remember years ago, before I ever met Dr. Deming and learned about Kaizen, there was this world famous pain expert at UCLA doing a talk on cancer pain. At the end of the first night, he said to these patients, "I'd like you all to go home and meditate for 1 minute." Well, I thought that was one of the dumbest things I ever heard. 1 minute of meditation couldn't do you any good. So I waited for everyone to leave, and as politely as I could, I said, "Professor, why 1 minute? It doesn't seem very long." He patiently asked me, "How old's meditation?" I said, "Thousands of years old." He said, "That's correct. There's a very good chance everybody in this room has heard of meditation before tonight. Those who like the idea have long ago found a book or a teacher, and they're doing it. For the rest of the people in this room, meditation is the worst idea they ever heard of. I'd rather they go home and meditate for 1 minute than not meditate for 30. They may discover they like it. They may forget to stop."
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the mechanisms by which Kaizen works.
Right. There's in the book, it says people who struggle with Kaizen do so not because the steps are hard, but because they are easy. They can't overcome the cultural training that says change must always be instantaneous. It must always require steely self-discipline, and it must never be pleasurable. So it's interesting. There's this cultural training that makes us resist this idea of the small step, of doing the ridiculously small step. Yet, once we do that small step, that same cultural training is what causes us to do more than that? Or is that what's happening?
Yes. Sometimes people, because again, we're a Western culture and we put an emphasis on innovation, taking large, large steps to accomplish a large goal. And the idea that you can get there sometimes even quicker with very small steps is just counterintuitive and goes against our cultural grain. And so you're absolutely right. What some people do is they start down the Kaizen path, and even if they're starting to get success, they now decide they're going to do 8 different Kaizen things. They're going to work on their finances. They're going to work on their exercise. They're going to work on their relationship. They're going to work on their flossing, et cetera, et cetera. And they pile so many on that all of a sudden it's requiring willpower, self-control, discipline, the very things Kaizen is attempting to circumvent.
Mm. So Kaizen works because it does circumvent willpower, self-control. You said some other things in there. Can you talk a little bit about what are the mechanisms at play that make it work? What are we bypassing?
There's a couple things. One is, again, the conscious part of us that has a very busy schedule and obligations and responsibilities and duties, and we just don't have a lot of time to take care of ourselves. It tends to be put on the back burner. And again, if you think you need to drive to the gym, change your clothes, exercise, shower, put your clothes back on and go back to work or go home, everybody I know has got very good reasons why that's not an option. But if I ask you to take a walk at lunch or park at the end of the Costco lot or go up a flight of stairs or down a flight of stairs, all those moments, the brain register, the brain and body registers. So that's one way Kaizen works, is you're incrementally building a habit, because anything you do regularly, the brain commits cells to, and eventually, and if you talk to anyone that exercises regularly, they'll remember that there was a time when they didn't like it, then they tolerate it, now they miss it if they don't do it. So that's one way Kaizen works. The other way Kaizen works is you're training the brain for the leap you want it to make. You know, when I'm sitting in front of an audience, I'll say, how many of you remember the exact instant when you learned to drive, when you mastered driving? And maybe in a room of 100, one hand will go up. For most of us, we vaguely remember being in an empty grocery store parking lot with a car that's lurching down the road and a parent yelling at us, we're trying to control this monster, not sure how we're ever going to master this car and deal with traffic. And yet at a certain point, you're driving down the road completely oblivious to the fact the brain's now making moment-to-moment life-saving decisions. You learned it incrementally, and the brain made the leap into mastery on its own. So those are the two ways Kaizen works. You're building a habit, and or you're programming the brain for the leap you want it to make.
Right, because, and as you illustrate in the book, people can think of, you know, arrows going between these concepts. A large goal leads to fear, which leads to access to the cortex restricted, which leads to failure. So what's happening there, access to cortex restricted?
Well, what happens is a place in the brain where fear lives, it's called the amygdala. And so for many of us who are succeeding in some parts of our lives, if there's a difficulty we want to face, like we want to begin dating again or we want to go to the gym and we're afraid of looking at all these finely tuned people when we walk through the door, for many of us, change is scary. And the bigger the steps you feel you need to make, the more scared you get. And the most convenient way to deal with fear is to avoid whatever it is you're frightened of. So if you can make the steps so small that the amygdala stays quiet, then the brain gets to build in a habit. And the other thing that happens when the amygdala is on, when you're afraid, is the cortex shuts down. The brain doesn't want you thinking when you're being chased by a lion. It just wants you moving. So you lose your creativity. You lose your willpower. You lose your self-control when the amygdala is on. And so the bigger the steps for many of us, the more fear shows up. The smaller the steps, the less fear there is. The other thing that's connected to this is that many of us are very hard on ourselves. We're very self-critical. And so often the times we make changes are when life has, you know, kicked us in the butt with a disappointment. A relationship ended we didn't want to see end, or a financial reversal, or the doctor scares us with a diagnosis that's due in part to our neglecting ourselves. And at that moment, many of us are very angry at ourselves that we didn't figure this out sooner. And if you've got that harsh voice in your head, as many of us do, that harsh voice doesn't want to change tomorrow. It wants it yesterday. Today's acceptable. So if you've got this voice in your head beating yourself up, telling you what a loser you are because you didn't figure this out or avoid this or prevent it, that voice isn't interested in small steps. So it requires compassion. It requires surrendering this cultural focus on innovation. It requires a willingness to trust the process of small steps.
So there's this harsh voice. It is, that's kind of like the amygdala there telling us that we aren't going to make it. We're going to fail. But if we say, you know, I'll just, instead of going for the big thing, I'll go for the small thing. Well, then the harsh voice is kind of out to lunch, taking a nap. And next thing you know, over time, you've created some kind of a habit. You've bypassed that fear.
Exactly. You built in a new behavior without ever having to go through the overwhelming fear of having to do it instantly.
Yeah. I was so interested to come across your book because, well, it was showing up in Amazon as people who bought my book, The Heart to Start, also bought your book. And I was really curious, like, what this seems like it's totally unrelated. How could it be something that people are buying? But then as I went through it, I realized, oh my gosh, I didn't know about this Kaizen thing and how this idea of taking small steps is something I'm always espousing, telling people write 100 words a day or, you know, set a timer for 10 minutes and start working on something. And, you know, it's this bypassing of fear that works incredibly well. I didn't realize it was already a thing that you have been using in your practice with your patients. Can you talk a little bit about how you use it with your patients?
Sure. I work a lot because I'm in a medical center. I work a lot with people that have headaches and insomnia and anxiety and depression. And it's very difficult for people to make big steps. Again, in part because their lives are so overcommitted between work and family responsibilities, or they're just afraid to take a big step. But if you break it down into very, very small steps and convince them that they've already tried the big steps and the big steps haven't worked, you can get people to make extraordinary change. So we encourage people to again, park further in the Costco lot and walk as fast as you can so that you get your heart rate up to the front door of Costco, or take stairs. Anything that allows you to move more, getting up, standing and moving around, even a little bit burns calories. Going from sitting to standing doubles your metabolic rate. So there's all these moments that, the body's registering. So we encourage people and give them handouts on Kaizen so that they can see this is a technique that has been around for a very long time. And again, the good news is people have usually already tried the big steps and they haven't worked. It's not uncommon for someone to have joined a gym, went out and got new workout clothes, had a trainer, and it just was hard to sustain that level of discipline, self-control, let alone time, and life interfered with it. So it's sometimes easy to convince people if they've already tried the big steps and the big steps haven't worked.
And so how did you get interested in this? You told this story about somebody saying that people should go home and meditate for 1 minute. Was that like the beginning of your relationship with Kaizen? How did this happen?
No, I'll try to make this as brief as I can. But one of the things that, because I work in a medical center and treat people that have, they're coming to a medical outpatient clinic with all kinds of medical challenges and psychological ones. And one day I was walking through the UCLA Medical School Library and came across a book called Plagues and Peoples. And if you love history, Dave, it'll be the most amazing history book you'll ever read. The author makes the case very powerfully that the plague, smallpox, cholera, malaria, yellow fever, did more to shape the course of human history than virtually any other factor, and have been ignored in the way most of us have been taught world and American history. But there were small paragraphs in the book on how each of the plagues was cured. And I was surprised because, again, working in a medical center, I assume the way we cure a disease is we take the people that have it, subject them to whatever technology that we have or invent, and eventually find a cure. And sometimes that works, but none of the plagues were cured that way. Every plague was cured by somebody looking at who wasn't getting sick and trying to figure out why.
Mm.
So my research team at UCLA thought maybe this is why psychology's not made more breakthroughs. We've been sitting in offices since at least the time of Freud, working with people that had the courage to admit they needed help and were seeking it out. And out of helping some of them, we were creating theories, seminars, workbooks, talk shows on how to make your life work without really getting sustained results. So we thought, like the cure of the plagues, we should be studying success. And so we started collecting studies from around the world that follow people anywhere from 15 to 75 years to see who, over the course of time, in spite of adversity and setbacks and challenges, would thrive in all three areas. And then one day I was reading a paper and there was a full page ad for the Toyota Lexus. And it said for the 10th year in a row or something like that, it was the most highest quality car in the world. So I thought, well, maybe there's something metaphorically about building a car that I could use to help people build their lives. So I started reading a book called The Machine That Changed the World, which you would think might be about computers, but it's actually about the development of the automobile. And in it, they mentioned Dr. Deming and Kaizen. And so I Googled Kaizen, and there were something like 500 references, but they were all in the world of business. And I thought, well, something that's that powerful in business might have applications to romance and to health. And of course, we found study after study after study. And then, long story short, I bumped into somebody that worked for Dr. Deming and got to spend 5 days with him in one of his classes about a year before he died. So I got to hear it from the mentor, the guru.
Oh, wow. Right. I remember you were talking about the plagues. Wasn't there an example in the book of, you know, how the smallpox vaccine was created because of the milkmaids and who weren't getting cowpox?
Exactly. There was a small town British doctor overheard a milk, because smallpox was around before the birth of Christ. It's hard to imagine a disease more frightening. They estimate about 200,000 people at a time would die from smallpox, a third of Europe, they estimate. And was around until, again, this small town British doctor overheard a milkmaid bragging she was never going to get smallpox because she got cowpox. How she figured that out has been lost to history, but he went to study them. And before we knew about immune systems, he figured out she was right. And the vaccination had been around for a while, but he found a way to perfect it. And, eliminated smallpox. The way they eliminated was in malaria, because they couldn't figure out why all these people were dying in the Panama Canal, and realized that the people digging the canal were dying. The people on the ships who were delivering the supplies to them were perfectly healthy. And then they realized that maybe it had something to do with still water, and the still water led them to mosquitoes. And then that's how they cured malaria. So each of those four diseases were cured by looking at who wasn't getting sick.
Yeah, one little observation, one little thing at a time. But I'm wondering, how can I transfer that type of thinking to a way that will help me in my own life and work?
Well, in terms of life, the best place to try Kaizen is where you're most stuck. Mm-hmm. So whether it's exercise, whether I can give you some examples in relationship, any health issue, discipline around finances.
Well, actually, I heard there was an interesting podcast conversation I was listening to the other day between my friend Ramit Sethi and Tim Ferriss, and they were talking about how in their relationships that, so for example, Ramit and his wife have a weekly check-in where they actually have a Google Doc and everything. They go down this list of things that they have an opportunity to discuss these things. And it was shared on Twitter, and some guys was saying, you know, I don't think my wife would go for the whole Google Doc and weekly meeting thing. And that's when some suggestions came up, like you could start with one little thing. Is that like uh-huh. the type of way you might approach that?
The example that I use in the book is from what I consider the best marriage researcher in the world, a man named John Gottman and his wife, Julie Gottman. They're in Seattle. They were with the University of Washington for many years. And what makes their work extraordinary, because he was for many years a researcher, not a clinician, is he could sit you down at the time that he started for a 15-minute interview. Now it's a 5-minute interview. Predict the likelihood you'll be happily married 4 years later versus miserable or divorced with 93% accuracy. Mm. It's almost beyond imagination. Now, if you crystallize his data, it boils down to two things. One was how couples deal with conflict, which isn't surprising. Some of what he found was common sense, and some of it wasn't common at all. The second thing he found is positive attention outweighed negative on a daily basis by 5 positive to 1 negative on the days when the relationship wasn't going well, 20 to 1 on the days when the relationship was thriving. What's he talking about? 20 candlelight dinners, 20 trips to the movies? It's not even physically possible. It turns out to be small moments. When you call your mate during the day, does their voice light up when they realize it's you? Or does their voice tone imply that you're interrupting more important tasks? Do they put down the remote control, the newspaper, or the telephone when you come through the door? If you went to the dentist this morning, do they remember to ask you about it tonight? If you said you were going to be home at 6, are you home or calling to say you've been delayed? Those small moments accumulating throughout the day were more predictive of success than anything else the couple could do. So, and often so much easier than the things people think they need to do to be a good mate.
Mm-hmm. Now, so many of our listeners and myself, we are trying to pursue creative pursuits. We have things that we want to create. We want to write books. We want to start companies, things like that. But a lot of us struggle with this fear. What are some ways that somebody who feels stuck in a creative context can use Kaizen to move forward?
There's a couple ways to answer that. It's a great question. One is that a lot of excellent breakthrough products and services came out of somebody's momentary frustration. I'll give you some examples in a minute. And the other is that as we looked at breakthroughs in science, business, and art, we found often it was some incredibly small moment, too small for most people to pay any attention to, this person thought was worthy of a second look. Let me give you some examples. Walt Disney created Disneyland when he took his two young daughters to an amusement park. He puts them on the ride, sits on the bench, collects them, puts them on the second ride, sits on the second bench, collects them. By the third ride and the third bench, feeling kind of bored, looking around at the other adults who was just as bored as he did, he thought to himself, there must be a way for a family to share an amusement park together. We got Netflix from a gentleman who was avid Blockbuster. Some of your listeners may be old enough to remember Blockbuster Video. avid Blockbuster Video fan. One day he lifted up a pillow or something, saw a VHS that he had forgotten to take back, took it back to Blockbuster. They charged him a $43 late fine, and he thought there's got to be an easier way to deal with this. And of course, if you remember, Netflix started with DVDs, and they sent them to you three at a time, and the longer you kept them, the more money they made. We got barcodes from a gentleman who was trying to figure out how to help grocery stores with their checkout process, thought there had to be a way to speed it up. He could not figure out what to do. One day, feeling very sorry for himself, he goes off to the beach, staring at the waves, sticking his hand in the sand of frustration. Took his hand out, saw the sand sticking to the grooves on his fingers, and barcodes were invented that day. Hmm. We got the microwave from somebody at who was working at Raytheon, and he had a chocolate bar in his pocket. He was a little too close to a radar screen. The chocolate started to get a little soft, and he thought, that's interesting. I'll just give you one more example. I can give you half a dozen more, including The Simpsons, the longest-running scripted TV show in history, from a two-minute pace on a cable show somebody had watched longer than 2 minutes. Have I made the case, or do you want to?
Oh, yeah, I mean, you made the case, but
let me just give you, please.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah. Go ahead.
I just wanted to give you one more. We got the credit card from two businessmen in New York who were out to dinner arguing over the check until they realized neither one of them had any money. One of them lived a few blocks from the restaurant, called his wife from the restaurant. She came down with some cash. On the walk back to their apartment, the two businessmen, recalling that moment's embarrassment where they had no money, thought there must be an easier way to deal with restaurant charges, and Diners Club, our first credit card, was invented that night.
Huh.
So, I'm sorry, you started to ask something.
But yeah, I'm saying, like, a lot of those, they kind of put me in a place where I'm like, well, but, so they had this stroke of genius, and it's almost like, it almost ties into this cultural idea of us expecting to have a quick result in a way. I mean, are there any things that we can do that on a day-to-day basis that can help us be open to those moments or other ways to include small steps in making progress toward putting things out into the world?
Sure, there's a few. One was the one I mentioned, that is looking at where your frustrations are and seeing if there's a solution to that. And the other way is, one of the great mysteries of the brain is the brain cannot reject a question. Any question you ask repeatedly, the brain's compelled to pay attention to. And if I'm doing a five-day program in a hotel, I can demonstrate this to people. At the end of the first morning, I'll say, how many of you drove here today? Everybody raises their hand. I'll say, what color car was parked two cars to the left of yours in the parking lot? Besides thinking that's the dumbest question anyone ever asked them, they would have to admit they have no idea. I'll ask them the same question on Tuesday. They still look at me like, where'd they find this guy? by the third day at the earliest, David, fourth at the latest, pulling into the lot with far more important things on their mind, having been asked this senseless question three times. Their brain says a fool's going to ask you again about the color of the car, and they're forced to store an answer in short-term memory. So one of the ways Dr. Deming worked with Toyota is he simply asked each worker to ask themselves a question each day. And the question is, what small trivial step could I take that may improve the process or product? Just ask the question. He thought because it was small, it wouldn't trigger fear. And because it was the question, the brain would be compelled in its own magical ways to start a Google search. And of course, it's not a rapid search, but every one of us can think of some time when we were in the shower or we were driving to work or putting on our clothes and we got a solution to a problem. We posed the question, the brain took it in, and its own magical, mysterious way started popping out answers.
Yeah.
That's the other way that Kaizen works in terms of creativity.
Well, there's a couple of things going on here. One, I think that is interesting about your story about asking people the color of the car that sat next to them and how it's almost like their subconscious mind started to take over to where they couldn't help but notice. It reminds me of something that I did once when I was first learning Spanish, which was I would sit down with breakfast every morning and watch the first 20 minutes of the same movie every single day. And I didn't have to pay attention. That was the rule. Like, I don't have to pay attention. I don't have to do anything. It just has to be on in front of me while I'm eating breakfast. And, you know, at first, it just none of it made any sense. Yeah. But I mean, you can probably imagine what happened. Would you like to guess?
Eventually, you started to recognize a word here and a word there. Am I close?
Yeah, you start to recognize a word here and a word there. And on top of it, there's like this pattern recognition thing going on where then, I mean, I was living in a Spanish-speaking country as I do now. But, you know, as I go out throughout my day, I would come into these situations where I'd say, oh, how do I say that? Well, in the movie, they say this.
I hope that did never get you in trouble.
Well, in the movie, they say this. So, and sometimes I'd have to adjust a little bit, you know, which one thing that people often say is like, oh, just watch movies in whatever language you're trying to learn. But if it's all just one huge mess of nonsense sounds, it doesn't help. But when your subconscious is taking over and developing those patterns, then things start to happen. So that's one thing I noticed.
Yes, that's great. That's great.
So the other one, though, was you were talking about frustrations and asking yourself a question every day. I could see that being taken into an action if somebody wanted to stack that along with another habit, such as you go to bed every day, you know, write down one thing that one problem that you had during the day, like, that might sort of help you.
Mm-hmm. Yep, absolutely could work.
And you're also talking about these moments of being in the shower or I say like, you know, when you're waiting at the dentist or something, we'll often have these ideas and they pop into our head, but we kind of say, well, I don't really have time to write it down. I don't really have like a whiteboard in the shower or I don't want to deal with it or something. But having, I mean, for myself, I like to carry around like a little notebook in my pocket that I can write a thing down and there's a place for it to go. So there's like a capture element to it as well that might be helpful.
Yes, exactly. Yep.
Okay. So yeah, I'm starting to see some ways that you can use Kaizen in work or in creative pursuits. I know like for myself running an independent business, I always feel like I should have processes, but I'm only one person and for the longest time, I would get caught up in this idea of, well, if I don't have some sort of a well-written employee manual for every single process in my business, then forget about it.
Right.
But one thing I do now is every time I do a thing, I open up a little document. I've got a place for it to go. And I'll just write like one or two not that sophisticated things about what I'm doing. And then every time I do it, I just kind of add to it and things get better that way.
That's excellent. Yes. Yes. And you're training the brain to be thinking in terms of creativity and problem solving.
Hmm. Yeah. Well, and one of the ways I find that it helps me is that I'll often find that if there is a task that I want to do that feels particularly drudgerous and I just don't want to do it, I want to put it off. And I take that moment to just think about writing down what the task is, somehow it makes it feel less useless or less undesirable. I mean, can you dissect? Do you have any idea what's going on there?
Well, sometimes what I've found is people who make a list and then prioritize the things, particularly in the morning, that they don't want to do but need to get done, because we have more self-control and willpower in the morning than we do in the evening. That sometimes the list and the reward of checking something off the box is enough to get people started. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes what we found, for example, is sometimes people don't want to clean their house or do their laundry, or they don't want to organize their desk, or they don't want to do emails. So if we can get them to say, all right, I'm just going to do this for 2 minutes, that's it. 2 minutes in the morning, 2 minutes in the afternoon, whatever it is. You can often get people to do something for 2 minutes, and they start to get a sense of accomplishment and momentum. But the challenge is to honor that and not take the 2 minutes as a game and say, well, I know I said 2 minutes, but I'm going to do 30, and then they don't do it. So the trick is, if you're going to do 2 minutes, do it for at least a week before you start adding on by 30 seconds or a minute more each week. And eventually, again, the brain develops a habit.
And I think you kind of have to have this attitude that whatever you get over that 2 minutes then is gravy. Like, you still pat yourself on the back for the 2 minutes.
Exactly. And that's where that critical voice in your head comes in. And that's why I wrote the book, between the cultural belief that any big problem requires big solutions, and many of us have a very self-critical voice that thinks 2 minutes isn't enough, but we're not doing 30. So but that harsh voice is keeping us from even starting down the path.
Mm-hmm. Did you use Kaizen to write the book about Kaizen?
Yeah, yes. I confess, I hate to write. It's one of my least favorite things to do. So when I got a contract to write the book, and I think it was, I can't remember, was the deadline was 6 months or a year, whatever it was, I decided, all right, I'm going to have to put my money where my mouth is and use Kaizen. So I said, all right, since you hate to write, you only have to write for 1.5 minutes a day, which is how I started. And then what happens eventually is you forget to stop. But all I held myself accountable to before I gave myself a pat on the back was the minute and a half.
And was there a particular time of day when you did this minute and a half?
Usually in the morning, because as I was saying earlier, what willpower is, it's basically the frontal cortex, the front part of your brain. That's where the discipline comes in and saying, no, I know you want to go out and play, but you've got homework to do, or you've got a deadline, so you can't go to the movies. And it takes blood sugar. That's the fuel that the brain gets in order to do its work. And usually by the end of the day, we've depleted that blood sugar, add to it our physical fatigue. So I tried to take advantage of it when I was when the brain was most alert and awake. But if I got busy in the morning, I would do it just before I went to bed again, because all I owed myself was 90 seconds. What I assumed was that if I could do the 90 seconds, that eventually I would have I would start to look forward to that 90 seconds, because I was excited about sharing Kaizen with the larger audience. I just didn't want to do the work. So if I made the work easy and fun, and of course what happens after a while is you just forget to stop, which is what happens with Kaizen on a regular basis. If you overcome the resistance to doing it, because if you told me I had to sit down for 45 minutes every day, I can come up with all kinds of excuses why I don't have the time to do that. But what's the excuse for not devoting 90 seconds to something that I profess to love?
Mm.
So it breaks down all your resistance.
Yeah. And so by making it just 90 seconds, you were able to actually do the 90 seconds. And then you had a positive relationship with writing, because you could reward yourself, pat yourself on the back, all that stuff. And that could keep you going. But you did end up writing an entire book. I mean, obviously you didn't do that in 90 seconds a day. What happened?
Well, I told myself for the first 2 weeks, that's all you can do. Even if you want to do more, just do 90 seconds. After that, I said, well, all right, you're now going up to two minutes. And if you decide you want to do more, you can, but you don't have to. And then it became much more fun. And some days I would do an hour before I realized I had other things I had to get done that day.
And then when it came time to do edits and all of that stuff, what did you do to handle that?
Well, by the time, because I turned in the first draft of the book, and it was probably, I'm guessing I lost track, at least six different times the editor sent it back saying, more of this, less of that, and we need it in 2 weeks. So, but by then, the body of the book was done, and so to be able to jump in, because I could see an end in sight, there was a light at the end of the tunnel, then I didn't need Kaizen anymore, because I was excited to finish this project. But the book got written with Kaizen with small steps.
Once you had that mound of clay on the table and then a deadline to go on top of it, you were able to finish your sculpture each 2 weeks.
Yes. Now, the only time when you really can't use Kaizen very well, because, you know, as you probably know, if you get a book contract, you've got a fair amount of time. They don't expect you to write it in 2 weeks. But if you're in marketing or some other business process where you've got to turn something in the day after tomorrow, this obviously isn't an option.
Well, but you can at least, I would say in those cases, you can at least, you know, once you're done with one of those projects, quickly jot down what were some of the steps that took place and then review that document each time. And then eventually, I mean, I just remember the first time that I had an internship at an advertising firm and I saw the process document. And it had like numbers and letter coding to it. And I was like, well, they actually have names for this stuff that's going on. Like, what mind created this incredible process? But I imagine it probably took time.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
And then you do have something repeatable so that when you are on some sort of a tight deadline, you are in this kind of crisis mode thing. Well, there might be some sort of pattern that you can follow and it makes things go quickly. And maybe there's some things that you can do to make it so it's not such a crisis next time. Some things that you can have in place to be prepared for situations like that. So I'm just riffing on some ideas about how you might be able to use small steps in a situation like that.
Exactly. Yeah. And one of my favorite Kaizen techniques is something called mind sculpture. There's a book by that title. And it's very, very common in sports. And now we've, of course, applied it to other areas of life. That they discovered this as they looked at athletes who were recovering from injuries far faster than any medical person thought was possible. And what they found is the athlete would close their eyes, picture themselves actually on the ski slope or in the Olympic stadium, reaching for the javelin or skiing down the mountain. And they were spending their time practicing while their arm or legs were immobile. And it's based on a very simple principle. With your eyes closed, your brain is so stupid, it doesn't know where it is and is sending perfect messages to the body. So in his book, which it's not really a self-help book, it takes you through all the research. They found that if you closed your eyes and imagine you were on the treadmill, again, not just seeing yourself on the screen, but actually feeling like the treadmill's beneath your feet, you were burning 25% of the calories you'd actually burn in the gym, and the body was doing it perfectly. So if it's a fear of public speaking or a fear of asking somebody out or any other kind of activity, you're doing a sales pitch, you close your eyes, picture yourself in the situation without moving a muscle, what you'd say, voice, tone, gestures, and like a commercial, do it just 15, 20 seconds at a time, you know, half dozen times a day, and eventually the brain commits cells to it and you've got a pattern there.
And you can even use it to manage potential scenarios. Like, I remember you telling this story about Michael Phelps, and I guess in an Olympic competition, his goggles started to leak, but he had already practiced that with mind sculpture, being in that situation.
Yes, his coach had him before he got out of bed in the morning. I forget how many minutes it was, 10 or 20, something like that. He would close his eyes and be swimming and making turns and practice exactly what you said, what he would do if his goggles filled with water. And I think it was the Beijing Olympics where that happened.
So this can be something that you do before you even get out of bed in the morning.
Can, absolutely.
Actually, it would probably be a really good time to do it.
Yep. But the good time is when, for most of us, again, the sooner you do these things in the morning, the better. But it's the repetition of it that the brain decides is important. So you're better off doing it 3 or 4 times during the day for 30 seconds each than doing it for 15 minutes once a day.
Yeah.
Because, again, it's the repetition. That's how, again, that's why the commercials are so short, but repeated again and again and again.
Well, Dr. Maurer, I've really enjoyed talking to you so much. I really recommend people go get out One Small Step Can Change Your Life, The Kaizen Way. I thoroughly enjoyed the book. Do you have a final message for people out there who are, maybe they have some creative dreams that they want to follow and Kaizen might be able to help them?
To think in terms of paying attention to each moment. Mother Teresa said it beautifully when she said that life is a series of small moments, so that each moment you have a chance to be kind to somebody, each chance you have a chance to look and see what's working in your life and what isn't, and taking life a moment at a time. We are in such a hurry to move forward, you know, that we sometimes miss the very pleasure that we have in that moment, the way children see it. So slow down our thought process, if not our physical activity, so that you can see what's happening in each moment.
So to, I mean, kind of feel what is going on and be, I mean, that happens to me when I'm having these conversations sometimes, is that I'm looking at the clock and I'm trying to remind myself to really be in the conversation.
Yes.
Just as one example of that. So yeah, I really like that. Dr. Maurer, thank you so much for being on the show.
Oh, it's my privilege and pleasure, David. It's wonderful talking with you.
Great. Thank you.
Is Love Your Work helping you find your unique creative voice? Does it bring you the inspiration and motivation you need to become the creator and human you want to be? If so, please be a part of making this a special and nourishing and thoughtful show. Support the show on Patreon. You'll be an even bigger part of the show than you already are. If you contribute just a coffee a month, you'll be helping support the hosting and production of Love Your Work. Everyone has some unique creative gift to offer the world. Together, we can give people the tools they need to bring that work into the world. The world will be better off for it. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/Kadavy. This is a different kind of model for supporting the work that you love. The choice is yours. Vote with your dollars, put your money where your mind is, and keep Love Your Work going. Visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/Kadavy. As a thank you, you'll get early access, bonus content, and a discount on Love Your Work merchandise. Learn more at patreon.com/Kadavy. That's patreon.com/KADavyY. And if you can't support the show financially, and you've listened to at least 3 episodes, can you do me a favor? Write a review on Apple Podcasts. You can consider it your donation to help support the show. Love Your Work is brought to you in part by our Patreon supporters, such as mini sponsor Paula Spriggs, and top supporters such as Jeffrey Mason and Vitas Pinkovicius. This has been Love Your Work, and I'm David Kadavy. The theme music for this show is At Sea by Durena, from the album About Everything and More, by arrangement with Deep Elm Records at deepelm.com. Love Your Work is a production of Kadavy, Inc.